What is going on, everyone? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Christine Sine. This is such a fun episode. Christine has lived some life, we'll just say. So she starts off as a physician in Australia and ends up on Mercy Ships, which we just talked to Kendall Vander Slice about this recently, but Mercy Ships is a medical ship that sort of goes around just doing medical work in places that need it. But Christine was a part of getting the medical side of that ship up and running, which is awesome and such a cool story. And so we get into the background of that. But she's now an author and a blogger and lives in a intentional community. And Christine just wrote a book called The Gift of Wonder, which is an incredible book. And I think especially in the season that we're in, she talks about contemplation. And I think we could all use that in this season, a little, maybe a change of pace as we go into the, you know, get towards the end of Advent and into the new year this year. Like, contemplation is so important. And she has all these creative ways for doing contemplation. And so we talk a lot about that, some of the ways that she has in the book. And just, I think you're really going to appreciate her insight and wisdom in this episode. It's awesome. And so I can't wait for you to hear from her and maybe bring in some of these spiritual practices into your life. And so, before we get going on the interview, though, I just want to make sure you follow me on Instagram or Facebook at Theology of Hustle. You can also follow me on Twitter at Curry Blanford. And if you get a second, I would really appreciate you sending me a rating and review on iTunes or whatever app you listen to. It just helps to get the word out about the podcast. And it's always helpful if you can share this episode on any of those social media platforms just to tell other people about the podcast and about this great episode and this wonderful book. So, yeah, if you do all that for me, I'd greatly appreciate it. And enjoy this episode with Christine. Well, Christine, I can't say thanks enough for coming all the way from Seattle, you know, to talk with me here. This is fun.
That's it. All the way from Seattle just to talk to you, Curry.
Right. That's awesome. I love that you're having to be in Chicago and get to chat with me a little bit. This is fun. So
it's fun for me, too. Thank you for asking me.
Certainly. Okay, so let's jump off and just have you sort of introduce yourself to everybody.
Well, hello. No, as you can probably tell, even though I live in Seattle, I didn't originate in Seattle. I come from Australia originally. Grew up there, family, three brothers, and trained as a medical doctor. And then, like most Australians are actually the most traveled people in the world.
Is that true?
Yes. So it's not surprising, I suppose, that I have spent much of my life traveling. After graduating from medical school, I actually moved to New Zealand. I was in a family practice there for a couple of years. And then I joined an organization called Youth with a Mission, specifically what eventually became Mercy Ships. Okay. And I actually spent 12 years of my life living on board the first Mercy Ship, the Anastasis, and developing the whole medical aspect of the ministry for them. Never got over my seasickness. So actually my first book was called Tales of a Seasick Doctor. And my email is seasickdoctor@gmail.com. And I can still get motion sickness very, very easily. But in spite of that, you know, there were 12 incredible years and I did get the opportunity to continue to travel in a way that was much more meaningful than I think what I'd intended originally to travel. And have worked all over the world, worked in refugee camps on the Thai-Cambodian border in the 80s for a while. And, you know, worked in Africa, the Caribbean, just incredible experiences. And then I was married in 1992 to an American who kind of wanted me to stay in the United States.
That was American.
Yes. Even though he, as an author too, you know, had done a lot of travel and had worked in Haiti, that was part of what brought us together was that commonality of a sense of concern for, you know, particularly for the global poor. and for those who, you know, didn't have the kind of advantages that we have. So now I live in Seattle, and we live in a small community. It's a large house. It's divided into three apartments. We live in the middle apartment, and we have a family who lives above us with two little kids, a young couple that lives in the basement apartment. And then we have a very tiny room, a little like the room I lived in on the ship for many years, that we called the monk cell. Ah. And we have a young single guy that lives in that. We do one meal together once a week. And we do a garden day together once a month. Part of what we do is we grow as much of our own fruit and vegetables as we can on an urban lot, probably 40 to 50% of what we eat. And so I don't practice medicine in the United States, but I tell people that my passion for health and wholeness has grown. And the way that it has grown really has been in a growing interest, firstly in contemplative practices, but then much more creative kind of practices, particularly as I wanted to help people connect what they've got in their brains about God and about faith to what they have in their heart.
Yeah.
And so that is where The Gift of Wonder, my latest book, has come from.
I love it. I love it. The book's great. I can't wait to jump into some of that. Can we just back up, though? I have got to hear more about Mercy Ships and like how that all came about, because I know about the ministry. I've heard of it. I had a friend, I think, loosely affiliated with it. But like, how did all that sort of go down? You know, that's amazing.
Well, it was an amazing story. I mean, before I arrived, I think in 1979, the Youth with Mission had purchased a ship with the intention of renovating it, of, you know, mainly initially of using it for evangelism. You know, of course, if that was their intention, they shouldn't have put a pushy Australian in charge of the medical ministry. And so, you know, but kind of having a hospital on board was part of the initial vision before I arrived. And there had been a couple of doctors on board before I arrived as well. But, you know, I was the pushy Australian that managed to kind of get things underway and develop the hospital to do cleft lip and palate, eye surgery, medical and dental work. And, of course, the medical ministry has taken over the ship really since I left and has become the major focus for Mercy Ships. And, in fact, I say that my greatest achievement on the Mercy Ship was recruiting Dr. Gary Parker, who, you know, is the maxillofacial surgeon who really developed the maxillofacial side of doing not just cleft lip, but a lot of other much more complicated surgeries in that realm. And that has become very much the focus of Mercy Ships. Some of the other aspects of it have fallen away some, though they do amazing teaching, I know. The last time I was together with Gary and his wife Susan, we talked about the development of, you know, kind of off the top of my head, I can't think of the name of it, but it really helping people to develop best practices and particularly, you know, how you set up a surgery and make sure that you've tracked, you know, what's happened to everything. And, you know, that's something that they've been able to teach in hospitals and practices all over Africa, which I think is an incredible accomplishment. It really is. So
that's amazing. So you, I mean, for 12 years, you basically just like were on a ship and would travel from sort of port to port and like do medical work.
Yeah. It actually took, you know, 7 of the years that I was on board to get the hospital set up because we had no money. You know, one of the names of Youth with a Mission back in those days was Youth Without Any Money. and it was definitely true in the early days of the development of the ship. And so setting up the hospital and, you know, kind of getting together the kinds of supplies that we needed to be able to do surgeries on board took a lot of energy. It took a lot of developing connections. It took a lot of work. But, you know, the first book that I wrote, Tales of a Seasick Doctor, you know, tells at least some of my personal history of what that looked like and the challenges and the joys. You know, one of the joys for me was the development of relationships. In fact, the two women that I roomed with when I first came on board the ship are still my best friends. You know, that is amazing. And I think part of what melded us together was some of those extremely challenging kinds of things that we went through during those early days of being on board the ship.
Yeah, right. Well, because, I mean, in the book, you talk about a couple of the stories from Mercy Ships and like literally having no money and like praying for, you know, food or something, right? For like provisions. I mean, it was like it was just an intense time in general, right?
It was. Yeah. Those early days in particular, yes, were very intense. But we saw some miracles. I think one of the ones that I talk about in The Gift of Wonder is the time that we had been praying because we had no money for developing the ship ministry. This was in Greece, and we weren't even able to live on board the ship because of, you know, various things that had happened. And it was in a place that the Greeks called the graveyard, you know, because they really thought that it was on its way out. But we were living in a hotel that actually had been damaged by an earthquake, which was one of the reasons that 150 displaced missionaries were able to live there, you know, because they couldn't open it for the tourist season. And we were praying one day, looking out on the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, and somebody yelled out, "The fish are jumping." And we raced outside, and all along the beach in front of our hotel, nowhere else, there were fish jumping out of the sea. And we collected 8,301 fish that morning.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, it was miraculous. And it was that sense that God was saying, you know, I will provide. I will provide. And when I look at, you know, what Mercy Ships is doing now, I think, yeah, God provided.
Yeah.
It took longer than we'd hoped for. But, you know, I think that's so often the case. With what God does.
Very much so.
We have our timetable, and God's timetable is rather different for us.
Yeah.
And part of what God does during that time is God melds people together. God develops a relationship. God puts into our hearts the things that we need, both personally and as community often, to make the ministry possible.
Yeah, totally. That's awesome. I love that story. I'm so glad you shared that. It's just like, it reminds you of, you know, Peter casting the nets right on the other side of the boat.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just like, that is such a God thing to do, to have fish just like jump out.
That's amazing.
I love it. So, I mean, what was the why behind doing all that? I mean, I understand like helping people is important and all that stuff, but like what compelled you to like really do
me
all
personally,
that? Yeah.
I'm the kind of person that I think all of the major decisions that I've made in my life have had a sense that this is what God's calling me to. And I did, you know, when I was in practice in New Zealand, I had that sense that, you know, I had some good friends that were on furlough from the ship. I should say their mother was a good friend of mine. And so I got introduced to them, and I just had this strong sense that this was where I was meant to go. And, you know, when I look back, I think, wow, why?
Yeah.
You know, because, and I think most of my friends thought I was crazy. Because, and in some ways I was, you know, but then maybe a lot of my life, people would look back and say, I think you've been crazy, you know, because I've always been an adventurer, a risk taker. And I think that was part of what going to the Anastasis was. It was, but it was always done with this strong sense from God that this is where I'm calling you to. And even now, I think that's the case. You know, the books that I've written, the life that I've lived. Some people might say the decision to marry my husband. You know, they were kind of risk taking I was going into another new adventure. You know, moving from the ship to living in the United States into another culture was you know, in some ways a challenging step, but I knew this was where God was calling me to.
Yeah.
You know, moving into the area of becoming an author, when that was totally different from practicing medicine, was taking a risk, you know, but it was a risk that I knew God was calling me to. And not just writing, but, you know, I facilitate a blog, godspacelight.com, that is a pretty popular spiritual formation blog.
Yeah.
And doing that, again, something very different, but I knew that God was calling me. I think my focus, rather than just being on medicine, became how do I help people find wholeness? And for me, that part of that wholeness became how do I help them find the physical and the spiritual wholeness that God is calling them to. And so, you know, what that led me into was a journey into new expressions of spiritual development. And the culmination, at least at this point in time, has been the book, The Gift of Wonder.
Yeah, I love that. Can you talk just for a minute? I think this idea of the combination of the physical and the spiritual, so-called, is like a really, is something our culture struggles with, right? Like with Christians, it's very easy to just talk about like spiritual things, right? And I think neglect like the physical. So can you talk about that sort of intersection that you...
Yeah, I think part of what I recognize, particularly working in Africa, you know, which was the last major non-Western area that I worked in on the Anastasis. I and even my own situation, part of the reason that I had to leave the ship was because I became ill. I developed chronic fatigue syndrome.
Oh, really?
Wow. And in the aftermath of that, kind of looking at what went wrong, because I didn't believe that this was God's purpose for me.
Yeah.
And I think part of what I realized was that I'd overworked myself, you know?
Yeah.
And so I didn't have both the physical or the spiritual kind of resources that I needed to really avoid these kinds of situations, you know? And I recognized that most of the people around me didn't really have that either. You know, I think that one of the challenges that not just missionaries, but I think a lot of spiritual leaders face is that they focus on the spiritual, as you said, without the physical resources to help them become the kind of balanced people that they need to be.
Yeah.
Not recognizing that our spiritual health and our emotional health are closely tied to our spiritual health as well.
Yeah.
We can't compartmentalize these things, and yet I think we grow up in a spiritual culture that tells us that we can,
totally.
You know?
Yep.
So, yeah, I think spirituality becomes this little box, often marginalized in our lives. You know, it's something we do on Sunday.
Yeah.
And the rest of the week we do the other things.
Yeah.
And maybe we, if we have time, you know, we spend some time with God every morning. But even that has a tendency to become something we do on the move. You know, so many people, of course, do their, in a way, devotions or whatever you want to call it while they're driving along in the car. You know, and I love things like pray as you go, you know, and have really connected to Ignatian spirituality through that. But I also recognize that if this is the only thing we do in terms of our spiritual life, there's something really missing in terms of what our spirituality is all about. And so the journey of my life has been moving spirituality from the little spiritual box to, you know, recognizing the spirituality of everyday things and of everything that we do as well. And recognizing that spiritual practices, even though they encompass our traditional view of prayer and of reading the scripture, that there is a much broader form of spirituality out there, even much broader than, you know, the contemplative practices that I started to move into you know, like things like Lectio Divina,
yeah.
That many people have connected to these days, to contemplation. And of course, you know, some of the kind of much more broader practices that I talk about in The Gift of Wonder, you know, things like, I was telling somebody the other day, you know, not just walking labyrinths, but creating labyrinths and finger labyrinths that can be very, the whole process itself can be something that helps to move our spiritual, you know, ideas into our heart, out of our brains and into our hearts, I think. And so I like to talk a lot about that. Painting leaves, you know, not something we think about as very spiritual, but it can be a very spiritual thing as we focus in on what is it that God is saying to us in the process of this. Going for a walk in nature. Even, you know, basic things that we do, walking around the house. I mean, it's interesting to me that spring cleaning used to be a practice in Lent, in the season of Lent. And I think that maybe back in the history of the church, people had a much better way of connecting the things that they did in everyday life to their spirituality. But somehow we've lost that as we've moved along. We've made it a much more intellectual kind of pursuit. I think that's one of the reasons that people are moving away from church, is because they recognize that spirituality is much more than just our traditional view of prayer and our traditional view of reading the scripture, and they're looking for something more and they're not finding it in church often.
That's a great point. And I feel like it's really easy to know a lot of stuff about God, right? And we've become people who know a lot about God, but we don't know God, right?
Yes.
And there's a distinction there, a pretty significant one, right?
Yes. And I think, and it's not just we don't know God, but we don't know the God who is resident within us and the God whose image is hidden deep within us as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, those are very different. You know, instead of reaching outwardly, I think sometimes we need to reach inwardly to a certain extent. And not just, hesitate to say that, because we're not just reaching inwardly in terms of our personal development, but we're reaching inwardly to recognize the presence of God in the world around us as well. I love one of the streams of Christianity that I've become very interested in over the years is Celtic Christian spirituality. Sure. And the Celtic Christians, who thrived during about the 5th to 8th century, talked about that creation was translucent, that the glory of God shone through it. You know, not a kind of a pantheism or a worshiping creation, but worshiping the God who had created everything we see around it, and recognizing the goodness of God, the beauty of God, the wonder of God that shone in the presence of every aspect of creation and in the faces of every person we meet. You know, and that to me is wonderful. It is the gift of wonder to a large extent. But, you know, but a lot of the spirituality we learn doesn't help us to connect to that kind of a God, or that kind of a spirituality.
Yeah, totally. So let's jump into the book then. And I mean, you've already mentioned a couple of the practices, but and the, I guess the why behind the book, right? We've sort of talked about in a lot of ways, but how do you sort of organize this book, and like, what are some of the things that you talk about?
Well, what the book came out of was, yes, some of the background that I've talked about, but a few years ago, you know, I got riveted by the phrase, unless you become like a child, you cannot enter the kingdom. And it's kind of like, wow, you know, this is a phrase that I think many of us jump over. And yet it's mentioned enough times in the gospel that I think it's something we shouldn't be jumping over.
Very much so.
And so I actually posted on Facebook, you know, that great theological site, what do you think of the childlike characteristics that make us fit for the kingdom? And I was amazed at the responses. I mean, I think I got between 50 and 100 responses, and people mentioning all kinds of things, you know, playfulness, curiosity, love of nature, imagination, and, you know, dependency, trust.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, I think this is something here, you know, that people recognize that we need but don't know how to connect to. So I took 12 of the characteristics, the ones that were either mentioned most frequently or that I suppose grabbed my attention.
Yeah.
And those became the gift of wonder. And I don't deal with them in kind of airy-fairy, fluffy ways. I did, you know, probably because I'm a medical doctor, you know, I did scientific and medical kind of research looking at these kind of characteristics. And I was just astounded at the things that I started to discover. Mm. You know, for example, Stuart Brown, the head of the Institute for Play, says that nothing lights up the brain like play. Mm. And he says he believes that oxygen, that play is as important as oxygen for our survival. Researcher says that they believed that this is God's, that play is God's greatest gift to humankind. And I thought, wow.
That's a big statement,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, this is not only a big statement, but it's something. And I think, why don't we play?
Yeah.
You know, because the interesting thing, of course, is that not only are adults not playing, but kids are playing less and less as well.
Right.
We live in a world that is play deprived. That it suffers from nature deficit disorder, in which curiosity tends to be discouraged, you know, compassion fatigue. And I think, you know, how much of the compassion fatigue we suffer from is because we approach, you know, the situations of needs in with the wrong kind of approach.
Yeah.
So this is part of what became the background for the gift of wonder.
Yeah.
And it's changed my life, you know, just researching these things and looking into them. You know, for example, when I was looking at the whole area of awe and wonder, you know, and recognizing, you know, the research suggests that a daily dose of awe and wonder makes us more caring and compassionate people. And as a result of that, my husband and I decided to call our daily walks. We walk around. There's a lake near us that's about a 3-mile walk, and we do that most days.
Wow.
With our dog. Important. Yeah. And so we decided to christen these our awe and wonder walks. And so as we walk, we point out to each other the things that give us a sense of awe and wonder. I mean, it revolutionized us. Not just in terms of our connection to creation, but our connection to each other. It was a fascinating process. So we still do it. You know, that was, 3 years ago. And we continue to do these as awe and wonder walks. Mm. And as the seasons change, you know, one of the things that I like to do is talk to each other and say, you know, kind of, okay, we loved this about the season that's passed, but you know, what are we looking forward to in the coming season?
Yeah.
What are the things that we think are going to give us a sense of awe and wonder?
Yeah.
You know, for example, in the winter, looking forward to the winter as the leaves fall, you know, something we never see in the other seasons of the year is the skeletons of the tree and the beauty of those.
Yeah.
And that's something that gives me a sense of awe and wonder as I look at that. And, you know, the hidden things. We talk about spiritual lessons, you know, the hidden things of God that are only revealed at certain seasons of the year. So, so it's been a fascinating process and an ongoing learning process for me as well.
Yeah, wow. No, I love the awe and wonder. It's just, it's so important. And it's just interesting to me, like talking about children and sort of that being the background of this book, and that like most of our churches revolve around all the adults being in one place and all the children being sequestered
exactly.
elsewhere, right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
It's like Jesus literally says, you must become like these children if you want to enter the kingdom of heaven. And we put that resource as far away from us as possible.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It really is, you know, and And I think what was interesting, when I was working on the book, a fantastic resource for me is a good friend who's an expressive arts therapist.
Yeah.
And so every time I was working on a chapter, I'd say to her, Kim, you know, what should I do to help with this? And, you know, for example, when we're talking about the awe and wonder, you know, one of the things I said, and she said, read some children's books, you know, yeah. and this, in fact, this was often her response, read some children's book or go out and doodle or, you know, kind of some of these very simple kinds of things.
Sure.
And, you know, the reading children's books was a wonderful kind of opening a door for me. Because part of what it gave me permission to do was go back and read some of the books that I'd loved as a child.
Yeah.
Books that probably most Americans have never even heard of. The Magic Pudding, The Adventures of Cuddle Pot and Snuggle Pie, The Bunyip of Berkeley's Creek. Have you heard of any of those?
I've not heard
no,
of any of those.
I'm sure.
No.
Well, go and find them.
Okay,
you know?
Okay. I'll put them in the show notes for sure.
Because, you know, I think reading children's books can be a place, and even better, read them together with kids, you know. I don't have kids or grandkids. And so, you know, I mean, to a certain extent, I've been even more disconnected from this resource. But reading some children's books and, you know, getting together with the children of friends and reading some of these books together has definitely provided a delight and opened a doorway into a world that has given me joy and I think has opened up, you know, aspects of who God has intended me to be and who God is as well. I mean, because unfortunately, I think very few of us believe in a God who loves to laugh, who loves to play,
yes.
who is a fun-loving God,
yeah.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
We've kind of grown up with this authoritarian image of God.
Yeah.
And I don't think that is who God is. And I don't think that is who God intends us to be either. You know, there are times we need to be very serious.
Yeah.
But there are times we need to enter into joy and into play and recognize that God is present in the midst of those and that God delights in us when we're doing those kinds of things as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Why does God have to be so serious all the time, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because uh-huh. It's not part of our built-in person. We're the image of God, right? And we're not made to be serious all the time. Look at, like you said, children. I mean, just born into us to play. You
yes.
know? And it's
yes.
interesting, like even we do some work with children from hard places, you know, adoption and foster care. And one of the greatest ways to sort of work with children who have experienced trauma is to play with them.
Exactly.
It's like the ultimate,
yes.
you know, breaking down of barriers. And,
oh, yeah. Play therapy has become very important for working with children.
Yeah.
I think, why do we stop? You know,
that's a great question.
When they become adults,
that's
you know,
a great question.
And why do we stop? As you said, not only do we disconnect children from adults, but the kinds of things that we find are effective ways to do spiritual formation in children. One of the things that I talk about in the book is godly play. You know, I think the best children's curriculum that I've come across and is broadly used, you know, it's very easy to find online.
Yeah.
But it has wonderful techniques, you know, asking questions, using techniques that bring children alive in terms of their spiritual development. And a lot of the people that have grown up using godly play are taking it into their adult lives.
Sure.
Because they're recognizing that they need these kinds of approaches to spirituality. So I've learnt from them.
Yeah.
And I've seen, you know, that kind of joy of spirituality that this often develops in kids and adults, and recognize that this is something that I think all of us need.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Well, and even your book, The Gift of Wonder, is about creating, about creative practices to finding God, right? It's not just like the same old thing. It's, you know, how do we experience God in like all these different ways and all these different areas? Can you talk just about some of the ones maybe that jump off to you off the top of your head of like the creative ways of experiencing God?
Well, firstly, let me say there are a lot of creative suggestions
sure.
in the book.
Yeah.
I don't expect people to use all of those.
Sure.
Somebody said to me, you know, there's so many. How can we do it all? I said, I don't expect you to do it all.
Yeah.
But what I do hope is that as people read the book, they'll find, hey, that sounds very interesting to me.
Yeah.
And different things will attract different people, of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, some of the ones that I find interesting, you know, I mentioned earlier, maybe because I'm getting ready for a workshop that I will be doing this, is painting leaves.
Yeah.
And I talk about this in one of the chapters, where particularly during the autumn, during the fall, you know, this is a wonderful process that I certainly enjoy doing. And when I use it with groups, I find people really come alive.
Sure.
And getting them to go out and to collect leaves and then talk about, you know, what is it that they're grateful for in particular over the season that's passed? And what are they looking forward to? This, you know, particularly here in the United States, where the season of the autumn season is leading up to Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
You know, I think that collecting the leaves and looking at the beautiful things, you know, as things are dying, it's amazing how
yeah.
beautiful they are.
Right.
And then what I like to do is to paint the leaves, then cover them with Mod Podge or some kind of a sealer, you
yeah.
know,
yeah.
and then use them to decorate the table with. And they will last for a couple of months if
yeah.
you do that at this season. So that's one that I talk about in the book. I spell it out a little more fully on the blog, godspacelight.com. In fact, I did that yesterday on
okay,
the blog.
Yeah.
The other fun one that I love is using a finger labyrinth. You know, most people have heard of labyrinths
yeah.
and many people have walked labyrinths, but what they haven't heard about often is finger labyrinths. And interestingly, finger labyrinths have been found in churches going back to the 3rd and 4th century.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
And they think
wow.
that probably people who couldn't, people used it as a form of meditation.
Yeah.
Or people who couldn't afford to go on pilgrimage, that they would often walk the labyrinth either with their finger or, you know, in their lives, you know, as an alternative to pilgrimage.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Can you just real quick, because I think there's a lot of people probably listening that don't even know what a labyrinth is in the first place. Can you just talk about what that even is and the history of that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, a labyrinth is a path, basically, you know, not to be confused with a maze. You know, a maze is a path that you're meant to get lost in. A labyrinth, I suppose you could say, is a path that you're meant to get found in.
I love it.
Because basically it has one path that leads you to the center. And then so you walk into the center and then you walk out again. But it's not just a straight kind of a spiral or something like that, but it's a fairly complicated path. And there are many different kinds of patterns for a labyrinth. The most famous of these would be the one in Chartres Cathedral in France.
Okay.
And it dates back, I think, to the 8th or 9th century. I could have that wrong, and I'm sorry to the historians who are more accurate than I am in there. But labyrinths do date back. You know, they predate Christianity.
Mm.
And I know because of that there are Christians who are very cautious of these. But as I said, you know, labyrinths have also been found in churches dating back to the early days.
Right.
So this was a form of contemplation and meditation that Christians have used virtually throughout the history of Christianity. And that many Christians find extremely helpful today, and not just as a form of meditation, you know, and the idea in Christian meditation is that you're walking in to find God at the center.
Yeah.
And then often you're walking out to take God out to the world. At least that's the way that I've tended to use it.
Yeah.
But labyrinths can be used in other ways too. They are actually good problem-solving tools. And, you know, they say if you walk a labyrinth with your non-dominant hand, you know, finger labyrinth, I should say, with your non-dominant hand,
yeah,
asking a question. So you ask the question as you start the labyrinth. You go in a prayerful way, ask the question again when you get to the center, and then walk out again. The chances are that by the time you get to the outside, you will have the answer to your question.
Interesting.
And I used it a lot while I was working on The Gift of Wonder. In fact, I have a beautiful Chartres labyrinth, a finger labyrinth that somebody gave me several years ago that I use a lot when I'm working on projects. And I do find that if I'm, you know, grappling with an issue that I'm struggling with,
yeah,
that to sit and to prayerfully walk that labyrinth is a wonderful experience that helps me to solve the problem that I've got, or to at least find solutions to the issue that I'm grappling with.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've really appreciated that.
That's interesting. I love that. That's cool. Thanks for delving into that.
Well, and so one of the things that I talk about in the book is not just the process of walking it, because I found that it's can be a contemplative process, not just to walk a labyrinth, but to actually create one as well.
Sure.
Particularly the finger labyrinth. And so I talk about creating a finger labyrinth, you know, and I talk about some of the resources that are available online for doing that.
Yeah.
And again, I use it a lot when I do workshops. And I have posted on my blog, you know, kind of the step-by-step process of how you can put together a finger labyrinth in this way. And, it's a fun thing to do.
That's cool.
You know,
that's really cool.
A fun thing to do with kids.
Yeah.
I did one recently where I had a couple of 8 and 9 year old kids, and of course they just loved doing this, and the adults loved it too, because I think it gave them permission to play. We did it with colored sand.
Oh, really?
When basically I had them trace the pattern of the labyrinth, and then we put glue around the pattern, and then we sprinkled colored sand over it. So it was very simple, but fun, you know, really fun to do.
Yeah.
Great thing to do with groups as well.
Yeah, I'm like, I need to go home and have my kids do that.
I
think that'd be super fun,
Oh, it is. Yeah. I think it's fun. You know, I'm going to be doing it with our community group probably next week as well.
That's awesome.
And I know they love these kind of creative approaches to things. It really gives a sense of bonding into the group and a sense of intimacy with God as well.
Yeah. Okay. So as I read your book, and I don't know, maybe I'm putting something on you that's not there, but like there seems to be sort of a throwback, or maybe not even a throwback, but there's a Christian mysticism sort of like throughout this thing, right? It's like very, just like doing practices that aren't like of the normal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like seeking God in different ways and stuff. But I feel like some people, maybe is there pushback for like, no, you know, Christian practices look like this certain thing. I mean, what do you say to people sort of that struggle with that maybe?
Oh, yeah. I think that people, you know, there are some people that struggle with the fact that, you know, for them, this is what prayer looks like. And this is what reading the scriptures look like. And I mean, firstly, I say that I think we need to be comfortable with what we're doing. You know, I do like to help people stretch the boundaries a bit, because I think that we all need to be continually growing.
Sure.
We need to be growing in our knowledge of God, and we need to be growing in our knowledge of what it means to worship God. And I think that some of what I'm talking about is, hey, here are some other tools that might help you worship God more fully and get to know God in a more intimate way. At least that's what it's done for me. And I know that it's done the same for people who have used the book. I mean, it's amazed me the places that people have been using the book, places that had not occurred to me. In grief counseling.
Yeah, really?
I had one woman who kind of emailed me and said that she used it through her own grief process. And that she was taking it to her her kind of 12-step grief group as well, because she really felt that this was something that would help others.
That's a heck of an email to receive.
Oh, huh? Yeah. It had me in tears, no actually. I've received several emails that have had me in tears as I've read about how people have used the book, you know, in ways that I certainly would not have thought of.
Sure.
You know, another woman who told me that her husband said how much more joyful she's been since she's used the book. Which was interesting, and hers, you know, because, and part of the reason that she was more joyful was because she had found other practices to help her connect to God. And I think that part of what I would say is that the practices we've learned are very intellectual kind of practices.
Sure.
And yet God has given us all kinds of senses, you know, through which we experience the world. And I think the senses through which we should be experiencing God.
Yeah.
And so part of what I try to do is to connect people to other kinds of senses, you know, to touch and to sight and to hearing and to these kinds of things. And it is grounded in mysticism to a certain extent. I mean, it kind of came out of my exploration of contemplative practices.
Right.
But I think that what the usual approach to contemplative practices lacked for me personally was that connection to all of the senses.
Hmm.
And so I wanted to help people to explore these on a broader perspective and a connection to everyday kind of a living as well. And that's part of what I wanted to do. You know, for me, it just kind of fell a little bit short.
Sure. Yeah. No, that makes sense. Well, and you talk a lot about your intentional community you live in, and that being a major part of sort of how you do these practices, right? Like even the children who live above you, like watching them play and as part of like, yeah, growing food and all that stuff. Gardening is part of like what your spiritual practices, like everyday life.
I have learned so much from gardening. You know, gardening as an individual and gardening as a community.
Yeah.
It's been a wonderful, not just spiritual practice for me, but kind of arena for learning about God. Mm. And, you know, early Christians believed that there were two books through which we learned about God. There was the book of the Bible and there was the book of creation. And I think that in our very important, you know, exploration of the book of the Bible, many of us have lost touch with that other book, the book of creation.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, I say that I learn about the story of God in the Bible. In creation, I see it lived out, you know. And so for me, creation has often been that connection between head and heart.
Yeah.
And it's so enriching for me and for so many others. You know, I'll often ask people, where do you feel closest to God? And I think this is particularly true for people that don't go to church regularly. And you say to them, where do you feel close to God? And I would say 80% of people say some aspect of nature.
Yeah.
You know, it may not be gardening, but it might be walking in nature. It might be sitting by the sea. It might be some aspect of nature. And the second one is some aspect of being with kids.
Yeah.
You know, so these were the things that I think kind of had me exploring the aspects of, firstly of nature and secondly of childlikeness as well.
Yeah. Awe and wonder is very difficult indoors, right?
It is. Though often I think connecting to the awe and wonder of creation can help us recognize the awe and wonder that is present in everything around us, you know.
You know,
because my eyes have been opened to the awe and wonder that I first connected to in creation, I can recognize the awe and wonder of looking at somebody's face and recognizing the presence of God in that person. I can recognize even the awe and wonder of electricity, of the things that we have a tendency of running water, you know, of water, of the indoor things as well as the outdoor things.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that the place that many of us or most of us initially connect to it of awe and wonder is in creation.
Yeah, I love that. That's good stuff. I really appreciate that. One thing I wanted to pick your brain about is you mentioned that you've been recently studying the Sabbath quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
Can we talk Sabbath?
Sure.
That's a practice that I've been practicing maybe 6 months or so, our family, you know, and it's just, especially on a podcast like this, where you're talking about work all the time, I think Sabbath is an important part of this discussion, right? Mm-hmm. Rest. So,
can I ask you a question?
Yeah, oh, please.
What does Sabbath mean to you?
For us, Sabbath is a 24-hour period in which we worship. Like, worship is our primary focus. So for us, throughout the day, we're asking, like, is this worship? And so if that is worship, then that's what we do. So, yeah, we delight in God, I think. Mm-hmm. So,
delight in God, I think, is a good response for me, because I think a lot of people, I think, misunderstand what Sabbath is about.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, Sabbath, you know, it's a good opportunity to rest, but the purpose of Sabbath is not to rest. Mm. You know, Sabbath, basically, you know, evidently the Jews struggled for a long time with what did God create on the seventh day?
Yeah, right.
And the conclusion they eventually came to was not that God created rest, but that God created the world as God intended it to be. Mm. So Sabbath is about catching glimpses of the world as God intended it to be. Mm. And to me, that revolutionized my understanding of Sabbath. So, you know, it's not the rules and regulations of you don't go out and play,
right?
Because you got to rest. You right. don't, you know, it's not a lot of you don't do this, you don't do that, right. you don't do something else. But it is, you know, how do you delight in God? How do you enjoy the world as God intended it to be?
Yeah.
On the Sabbath day? Yeah. What are the things? How do you delight in the people you love?
Yeah.
Because they are an expression of God's joy as yeah. well. How do you delight in the creation? Because that is an expression of God's joy and of the world as God intended it to be. How do you delight in, and even, you know, to the extent that for the Jews, the rest of the week was doing things that made it possible for them to enjoy
right.
The world as God intended it to be. So it was bringing rightness and wholeness to the world. That's what I love, you know, to think about the purpose of our work and of what we do is to bring the delight of Sabbath, not just to ourselves, but the possibility of that delight to others as well. You know, how has what we've done in the 6 days that precede the Sabbath made it possible for somebody else to experience the world as God intended it to be?
That's a great question.
I know. And one that I certainly struggle with a lot, you know, as you look at the world and so much of it that is not obviously as God intended it to be. Yeah. And obviously we're not going to be able to alone bring that wholeness. But how have we brought a glimpse of the wholeness that God intended for the world into being? You know, maybe it's just been by planting a tree. Maybe it's been by, you know, giving a donation to an organization that we feel strongly about. Maybe it's been by going out and talking to a homeless person or, you know, something small. But I think that, you know, what we do, you know, work is not meant to be about putting food on the table every day, though obviously that's important.
Right.
But God says basically, trust me for our daily bread.
Yeah.
And you know, focus on bringing in glimpses of the kingdom. I think that's meant to be so that we can give both ourselves and others a glimpse of the world as God intended it to be. And that's why I think, you know, going out and playing, going out and enjoying nature. I remember Eugene Peterson saying that he and his wife would always go for a long walk through, you know, the local forest, I think it was, on Sunday, because that was part of the Sabbath
right.
for them, was enjoying nature,
yeah.
Enjoying people.
That's and amazing, yeah.
Delighting in the community yeah. of God, too. So I think that, you know, Sabbath, therefore, becomes going to church not because, well, you go to church on Sunday,
right.
but because this is the community in which I delight in connecting to God yeah. with as well.
For sure. No, I appreciate that. And that's, yeah, it's so true. And like, it's so, I think Sabbath is so soul refreshing. Like it's what
meant to be.
Yeah, it's what we long for, right?
Yes.
it's a glimpse, like you said, of the new world. Yeah, that's great. I love that. Thanks for jumping into that.
Well, it's been so important for me. It has. It's been very important for me. My husband and I, on Sunday, we take time. We go. We have breakfast at a local restaurant, and we journal during that time before we go to church. Now, we're not pastors, so we don't have responsibility at church. And then we, you know, spend part of the time sharing with each other, you know, kind of looking back over the week. And part of what I instituted several years ago as part of my journaling is, what am I grateful for over the week? And so we often spend time talking about what are we grateful for. Yeah. And it's been become a wonderful Sabbath practice for us. And I think it does, you know, it helps us. And often more personal, what do we delight in each other, you know?
Right.
Sometimes it's a broader kind of expression of what do we delight in. But I think that that's an important kind of a practice too, of expressing gratitude to each other as part of our Sabbath observance as well.
I love it. That's great. It's great stuff. Is there anything we need to jump back into, you think, or...
Off the top of my head, I can't think of anything.
Okay, great. I really did. I enjoyed the book a lot.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, well, maybe just the fact that I think this is a book that is good for personal study, but I think is particularly good for group study, for retreats. As I said, you know, places that I've seen people use it that I hadn't expected, spiritual directors, grief counseling, all kinds of situations like that, but a lot of people using it as group study.
Yeah, I love that. I think,
Seminarians, you know, I have some seminary professors that are using it for seminary, their seminary students as cohorts as
really?
Well. Yes.
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
I love it.
Some well-known ones, but I won't mention them here at this point in time.
Awesome. I love that. No, I think you're exactly right. I think it's something you can keep going back to, right? It's like there's new practices that sort of jump out like probably every time you look into it. And
Well, it's interesting because that's even what I found is that because of the the publicity I've been doing, I've kind of dipped back into the book and things that I focused on, you know, kind of are things that I was like, oh, I haven't done that for a number of years. You know, I think I'll do that again.
Yeah.
And then for me too, it's led to the development of new practices, you know. And if people are wanting to look at some of those, you know, my blog, I both kind of spell out in more detail some of the things I talk about in The Gift of Wonder, but some of the things that I've started to kind of, or not started to practice, but I've found additional practices, like walking barefoot. Huh. That was one that I kind of looked at over the summer that I've enjoyed doing. I think a practice for the summer is walking barefoot, you know?
Yeah.
And I talk about the spirituality of that and some of the things that I've discovered. Or beachcombing. You know, there's a spirituality to beachcombing, flying a kite, some of these things that we don't, again, think of as spiritual practices that can give us amazing insights into God, you know, the wind of the Holy Spirit. Or, you know, the delight of noticing, you know, I think beachcombing is a wonderful kind of practice for helping us to notice, for example.
Yeah, that's interesting. Even when you say barefoot, one thing, my kids, I cannot keep shoes on my kids, right? Like they always want to be barefoot.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and there's research that suggests we need to go barefoot, you know?
Yeah.
And yet a lot of people... Yeah, they want to keep shoes on their kids.
Yeah.
They don't go barefoot. And, you know, it's interesting because, again, going through doing some research on the benefits of going barefoot over the summer gave me permission again to go barefoot again over the summer, you know. And it's been a wonderful experience.
That's good. Yeah. That's such an easy practice too, right?
Oh, it is.
But it's actually easier than putting on shoes.
But it's kind of, you know.
Yeah.
And most of the butts would be cured by going barefoot.
Right, exactly. If you were just barefoot more, it wouldn't be that big a deal. Exactly right. You're exactly right. Be more like those children that.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. Well, you ready to jump into the final two questions?
Yes.
Okay. So my first question, and this might be difficult for you, but my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
The strangest job. it's not difficult at all. It's a job that I had as a medical student.
Okay.
I hope this doesn't offend some of my people, but I actually had to process specimens of human feces for for experiments. Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Okay. It was the strangest job I've ever had.
I would definitely say that that's, what was the research exactly?
Well, it was, you know, for sometimes it was for tests that they were having done, but sometimes it was for research on diseases, of the bowel and things like that. But yeah, it was unusual.
Somebody's got to do it, right?
Somebody, unfortunately, and a medical, who better than a medical student to do it?
Yes, they get all of that stuff, right? Yeah, that's good. That's good. Okay, so finally then, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
Into their work. I would say, it may sound strange, make sure you take breaks during the day and spend time, if possible, outside at lunchtime.
Okay.
Because I think these are the kinds of things that help us to relax a bit, that help us to look at our work differently, and often help us, therefore, to be more effective in our work.
Yeah.
And I think often to be more congenial people to work with as well.
Yeah.
You know, because I think sometimes in the push for efficiency, we want to drive on and drive on. And yet the research shows that people that take rests during the day are actually more effective. You know, to the extent that NASA, you know, when people go up into space, they mandate periods of rest during the day for the astronauts because they recognize that they're more effective after they've had a rest.
Right.
So rest during the day, get outside at lunchtime.
I love it. That's such practical advice, and that's super helpful. That's awesome. I love it. Well, thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure getting to chat with you and talk. So.
And you too, Curry. Thank you for asking me on the show.
Certainly. I hope you enjoyed hearing from Christina this episode and just like maybe being inspired, right, to just jump into more contemplation or to, you know, go barefoot a little more often or maybe read some children's books in the upcoming weeks. I'd love to hear about some of the contemplative practices that maybe you've brought into your world or something that you want to try. I'd love to hear about all that stuff. I think it's really important. I think it's lost art for a lot of us Christians out there. We just don't know what to do sometimes or how to go about implementing these new practices. And so I'd love to hear all about that. Just a reminder to leave me a rating and review on iTunes or whatever app you use, and make sure you follow me on all the socials just to stay up to date with Theology of Hustle. And until next time, get out there and hustle.